You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, November 4th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a special guest rogue this evening, all the way from Hong Kong, David Young. David, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you very much. It's really good to be here.
So, David, you are active in the skeptical movement in Hong Kong. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, this is the epicenter for skepticism, or a lack of skepticism, actually. We have everything here. Reflexology is really big. Herbology is huge with our traditional Chinese medicine. We've got acupuncture, obviously a big deal. One of the things that people like to say about Hong Kong is that it's actually more Chinese than China. And that's because during the Cultural Revolution, a lot of the things that we still do here in Hong Kong were either banned or discouraged in China. And so now you can still buy feng shui books and feng shui predictions here that you can't get in China. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. In terms of what my group is actually doing, about 4 years ago, I was listening to one of your podcasts in which you guys described how to start a skeptical group. I remember you just said, like, just meet, get together, and if all you do for the first little while is have a few drinks, that's fine. And then after you have enough people coming, you can try lectures. About 18 months ago, we started doing lectures on a monthly basis, and we've done about 14 in the last 2 years, and they work out really well. We have about 30 to 40 people show up every
month. Good. That's awesome. How many people live in Hong Kong?
7.2 million is the official number, but it's about the density of the population. Mm-hmm. It's an extraordinarily small place. I think it's about 500 square kilometers in total. So, you know, if you think about that, you know, 10 by 50, very, very small place. And people are coming here more and more all the time. We also have about 10 million visitors a year. It's industry here. The finance industry is a really big deal here. So people are constantly visiting. So at any one time, the population could be anywhere between 7 and 8 million. But the real extraordinary thing about the population is not who lives here in Hong Kong. It's who's right across the border. From where I'm sitting right now, if I was to get in a car and start driving north, within 2 hours, I would pass 40 million people.
Holy crap.
Wow.
Oh, boy.
That's incredible.
Yeah. It is amazing. Right across the border is a city called Shenzhen, which is about 11 million people. Right next to Shenzhen is Dongguang, which is about 8 or 9 million people. And then after Dongguang, there's Guangzhou, which is a city, you know, before moving to Hong Kong that I'd never heard of before. But it's like the fifth largest city in the world with 20 million people. It's extraordinarily populated. The thing I like to say to Westerners about China is that it's difficult to understand the numbers. When you say 320 million people live in the United States, that's not even a third of the number of people. Actually, it's about a quarter of the number of people who live in China.
Yeah, China's not that much bigger than the United States. I think they're roughly the same size.
Yeah, very much roughly the same size. Maybe China is even a little smaller.
Yeah, and you can get by speaking English, right? But even though Cantonese is the official language, is that right?
Absolutely. It's one of the most discouraging aspects about learning the language when you come here is that a significant portion of the locals actually speak English and Cantonese, and many of them speak English, Cantonese, and Mandarin. So it's we always look like the we're always the undereducated ones, or I am anyway. And so as soon as you try to have a conversation with somebody in the local language, if you don't nail it, if you don't hit it right on, which is very difficult, it's a tonal language. And what makes it even harder, of course, is that it's written in characters. And the Cantonese often use the traditional characters, which are harder than the simplified. And so it's not like you can even read the word. If someone was to write down the word, you know, that you wanted to know, it would just look like a series of lines on a page. It doesn't look like a word to you, so you can't even pronounce it. So you have to hear people say it. And so when you engage in a conversation in the local language, they'll just start talking English.
Right.
You know, they're not gonna struggle through trying to listen to you speak Cantonese.
Hey, so do you have any exciting guests coming up at Skeptics in the Pub?
We do, as a matter of fact. very, very exciting. On our next Skeptics in the Pub on November 20th in Wan Chai, Rebecca Watson is coming to
What? Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
I am.
You are?
Yeah. No one told me.
Yeah. I am.
It's too funny. You know, I'd love to tell a story. Because the last time you guys went to Australia, I said, gee, I should have went. And then I thought, you know, it's kind of on the way. And you guys always said, when you came back from Australia last time, remember on the show, you kept saying, we're going back. So I said, okay, well, the next time they go, I'll write and ask them if they want to come. Here I was thinking that by that time, I'd have this huge monthly event with hundreds of people. And, right. You know, oh, skepticism is going to be so easy to get going in Hong Kong. But as it turned out, my dreams didn't come true, but part of it did. So I wrote to you, Rebecca, and said, would you like to come to Hong Kong on the way to Australia? And nothing. Weeks go by, and then all of a sudden I get a message that says, yeah, I'd like to try that. And I remember the first thing I thought was, oh, no!
What am I going to do now?
Yeah, what do I do now? She said, yes. Okay, scramble. Yeah, so it was, but no, we're really excited about it.
And as I mentioned when we did a show a few weeks ago with an audience online, and you were in that audience, I mentioned that I was pretty sure it was a scam because I don't often get invited to Hong Kong out of the blue. And that's why I think my first response was just like, yeah, sure. And I thought, well, let's see where this goes, you know, let's see if this guy turns out to be scamming me. But no, you are for real.
So you have two public events while you're here. You've got a handful of events, but the two public ones are our local Skeptics in the Pub here in Hong Kong on the 20th, and then we're going to China.
Yay.
So we're going to pass through those 40 million people and go to Dongguan and have an event there on Friday night. And honestly, I cannot tell you how that's going to turn out. We might be standing around with our hands in our pockets, which will be fun, right?
Yeah, I have no idea how many fans we have in mainland China who happen to be right there. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, regardless, we'll have a good time. So
That's exactly right. We will enjoy ourselves. And you'll get to see China.
And then maybe by next year, you guys will have hundreds of people coming out to Skeptics in the Pub, and then you can bring all of SGU out.
Oh my God, that'd be so awesome.
Or we can just bring you one, I'm happy to bring you over one at a time.
Oh yeah.
Well. Steve, I'd love for you to come and talk to medical students here. But
David, holy shit, you're trying to replace us with android robots.
One by one.
Westworld.
That's brilliant.
All right, and we'll talk a little more about pseudoscience in China later on in the news segment.
But first, let's talk about X-rays. Happy birthday, X-rays.
Yay.
Did you guys know it was the birthday of X-rays?
I had no idea.
Well, it is.
X-rays did not exist before.
They did not exist.
They were born then.
In 1895, on November 8th, German physicist Wilhelm
Röntgen.
Really?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I think in German, the G is soft. I think it, isn't it?
Röntgen.
Anyway, he was messing around with cathode ray tubes and electricity.
Oh.
And he happened to, he covered one of the tubes in a heavy black paper, basically. But when he sent the electricity through the tube, he saw a fluorescent light showing up on a screen a few feet away. And he, that set him on the path to figuring out that he had discovered a new ray, which he called X-rays, X being the mathematical term for unknown. Although the rays are called after his name in other parts of the world, apparently. But here they are, X-rays. And yeah, he immediately started doing experiments on X-rays, although he kept them quiet, thinking that if he was wrong, he would be laughed out of science. But it just so happens that he was right. And so he became like the father of radiology. And he, one of the first X-rays he did on his wife Bertha's hand, which was pretty impressive. Like when you look at it, you're like, wow, that was the first X-ray, but it looks awesome. And she apparently said something really awesome too about how she felt like she was seeing her own death, which is really cool.
She said, wunderbar.
I can't even imagine how it would be to like suddenly out of nowhere to be able to take a picture of your bones. You know, that would be terrifying. and awesome. So yeah, by 1896, X-rays were being used in the U.S. for, you know, for clinical purposes to take pictures of bone fractures and such. So it was a pretty fast turnaround. So happy birthday, X-rays.
Cool.
How long was it before they figured out they were dangerous?
Well, interestingly, he did not die of cancer due to X-rays, it is believed, because, you know, unlike many other researchers who discovered these sort of things, because he was one of the few researchers who always used lead shielding, like from the almost the very start. So I think that it was known pretty quickly that these were dangerous, although how dangerous wasn't discovered for quite a while, I think.
By the early 1900s, so it didn't take too long to figure that out. It's funny. I mean, it's kind of a quaint term, but we still use like a Rontgen graph or Rontgenography in medicine for an X-ray.
Yeah.
Again, it's kind of a quaint term, but I still hear that every now and then.
Although I feel like X-ray is the quainter term. Like X-ray sounds like something from science fiction, like something that has yet to be named because it's so new. So it's weird to me that we're still using the term that was coined 100 years ago.
It's just so familiar and common that I don't think of it that way, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, the Rontgen's a, yeah, that's where I've heard it before. They use it. It's a unit of measurement of X-rays. It's how you, I guess, add up how much exposure you've had.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. The one other thing is that I should mention that he got the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery. Mm-hmm. It was the first Nobel Prize in Physics. So
the very first. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's very worthy.
All right. Well, Jay, last week we talked about the explosion shortly after takeoff of the Antares rocket that was supposed to be a resupply to the International Space Station. And then between recording the show last week and our show going up, there was a second crash, this time Virgin Galactic. So tell us about that.
So Virgin Galactic has a suborbital ship that they've been working on for the past 5 years or so. And the point to the ship is to allow people to, in essence, just have a ride into outer space. It's supposed to be something that's going to bring excitement to space exploration, and it's also supposed to bring space to the public. You know, that being said, of course it's going to be very expensive. A lot of people have prepaid for a ride on this ship that Virgin Galactic has been refining over the past few years. But unfortunately, very recently, during one of the test flights, there was a critical accident, and a mechanical accident, and one of the pilots died, the other one was severely injured. What happened so far, now this is the information literally has just come out today, and today is the 4th of November. The tail wings of the airplane are called a feathering device, and there's been quite a bit of talk about these in the news. Now these are movable, so they can be in the horizontal position, which just makes the aircraft or spaceship look flat, or they can be in the up position, which makes an L shape out of the aircraft. And they were designed this way depending on what the ship is doing. So when the ship is gaining altitude, the wings are locked and in the back position regarding to the fuselage. So the wings are actually supposed to be locked until the airspeed hits 1.4 Mach, right? Mach 1.4. And what the cockpit video and the telemetry that was recovered from the crashed ship has shown is that one of the pilots unlocked the tail wings prematurely. They unlocked the tail wings when they were only going about Mach 1. And it was reported that roughly 2 seconds after that, the ship, they lost contact with the ship and it broke apart. So what's very likely is that one of the pilots unlocked, they actually saw it on the camera that the pilot unlocked the safety mechanism and the feathering device or the two rear wings just probably popped up, vibrated horribly at that speed, and a terrible accident occurred. This is, you know, I know that we don't have video of it, but it probably happened very, very quickly at that speed. Sir Richard Branson, owner of Virgin Galactic, told the BBC that safety is all-consuming to them. If any one of their 400 engineers said, hey, you know, I'm not confident that this thing is safe, they wouldn't have put it out for test, because there's been a lot of talk in the news since this happened the end of last week that you know, one of the engineers was saying that it's dangerous and nobody was listening. He also commented that the event was covered very poorly by the media, bringing in experts who have you know, no idea what actually took place. And, you know, now that they're revealing some of the information that they discovered, it just proves that they had no idea. They were blaming the event on the new fuel system and faulty engines and the fuel tank. So they were wrong. He said that the fuel tanks and the rocket engine were not the cause at all. It had nothing to do with that. And it really did revolve around a mistake by one of the pilots. So under normal flight conditions, the tail wings are used when the ship is at its highest altitude at 110 kilometers or 360,000 feet, right? So they're in the back position until it hits its top orbit. Wouldn't even really say it's orbit, and it's
arc. Not an orbit. It's suborbital.
It's a big arc as it goes up and comes down. So that high up, there's no atmosphere. The views are absolutely incredible, but it's also fanatically dangerous. And, you know, this is a clear example of just how dangerous it is. So they think what happened was that one of the pilots unlocked the dual wings in the back it allowed them, I guess, to rotate up to their 90 degree. And at that speed, before it had exited the atmosphere, you know, the vibration, like I said, was so horrible that it probably just ripped the ship to shreds. Now, those wings are very critical for the balanced reentry. So they were saying that's kind of like a shuttlecock. How when you hit a shuttlecock with a badminton, the nose is always pointing forward and it orients the shuttlecock so it flies very good because it changes direction so quickly. But they're saying that these wings operate in a very similar way. When they're engaged and in the up position, it orients the ship in a belly down orientation to the atmosphere. So it slows the ship down. They're using the atmosphere to actually slow the ship down quite a bit. And the ship is totally unpowered when it's reentering the atmosphere as well. And this is why the tail wings are why the ship doesn't need any thrusters whatsoever to help it position to stay in that position.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. You know, it's tough to have two crashes within a week, basically.
You know, like I said last week, this type of exploration is important. Horrible accidents are going to happen. But it's our human nature, and it's part of what we do. And I feel terrible for the pilot that lost his life, but I also am very encouraged to see Virgin Galactic pushing forward and not letting it slow them down.
I don't know that it's not going to slow them down, though. I mean, they certainly have to. Yeah, they lost one of their ships, and this is certainly going to delay their testing, you know, to get this thing to the point where they could actually start sending up tourists.
Yeah, but they're going to keep doing it, though, right? They're going to pursue it. They're not giving up.
That's what they're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems to me these kind of accidents should be, you know, they're unfortunate, but they're almost expected at this level.
The tolerance for error is so tiny. But hopefully, you know, this will all be part of continuing to move forward. You know, they'll learn from this. They'll tighten up their protocol so this kind of thing can't happen again. This reminds me of the Checklist Manifesto. You guys remember that book?
Mm-mm. What happened?
It's just the whole point is that when you have very low tolerance systems like this, where the slightest human error can result in catastrophe, you have to have systems in place that make it almost impossible for this kind of error to occur. It's got to be automatic. You can't rely upon training. You have to have a system.
I'm actually an ex-Air Force pilot, Steve. And so I understand the checklist system better than most people. And when I read about this particular story, it's the first thing I thought, you know, there was this, either this item was not on the list or it was in an appropriate spot in the list, or they just haven't yet developed the list that they need to make sure this doesn't happen. Yeah. I think one of the most interesting things is when doctors started following checklists in surgery, how errors went down.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The checklists are all over the place now. It's a good idea.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's move on. The next news item. So last week we talked about Australian politician who was promoting dowsing for finding water. And for fairness, since we're going to be visiting Australia and New Zealand soon, I thought I would have a New Zealand story that's similar. This one is about a New Zealand Green Member of Parliament, Stefan Browning. And he wasn't recommending the use of dowsing to find water. He was recommending the use of homeopathy to treat Ebola.
Oh, boy. Uh-huh. Oh, it hurts.
What an idiot.
Like a shot to the gut.
He signed a petition asking the World Health Organization to help develop and distribute homeopathic remedies to end the Ebola epidemic. So he was Fortunately, he was pretty immediately and soundly criticized for this, and he publicly acknowledged that perhaps it was unwise, quote-unquote unwise, of him to sign the petition. So he was asked about it. He did the typical politician thing. He was asked whether or not he thought homeopathy could cure Ebola, and he said, this is now in quotes, "It's not for me to go down that track at all. The World Health Organization, World Health Authorities are doing that." So that reminded me.
Typical.
Of, yeah, like.
Global warming.
Almost every Republican now who gets asked about, you know, evolution or global warming, it's like, that's not me to decide. We'll let the scientists decide. But they're just deflecting the question. It's like, well, the scientists have already decided. We want to know if you accept the scientific consensus on this issue. It's like, well, who am I to judge? We'll just let the World Health Organization sort it out. It's a dodge, you know.
Does the Earth go around the sun? It's for the scientists to tell.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Bruh. I mean, that's exactly right. I'll let the scientists decide. Well, we want to know if you understand that the scientists have already decided this question. You know, homeopathy is complete 100% bunk. It's a fairy tale. As I like to call it, it's fairy dust diluted out of existence. That's your average homeopathic remedy. The starting substances themselves are completely fanciful and have absolutely no relationship to how the body works or health or disease or anything. Then they get diluted mostly to such a degree that there's no original substance even left anymore. So there's no possible way it could work. And when it gets studied, it finds that we find that it doesn't work. It's a placebo. It's all it is. It's a literal placebo. Now, homeopaths have been promoting the homeopathic nozodes, which essentially is you take some phlegm or blood or something infected tissue from somebody who's sick, you dilute it out of existence, and that's a homeopathic nozode for whatever they were sick with, right? So you get take an Ebola patient, have them vomit in a bucket or something, you know, take a drop of that, dilute it, you know, 10 to the 30 times, and then that's you get your Ebola nozode. But I hope that doesn't stop homeopaths from claiming that, yeah, you know, they could be helpful in an epidemic. This is one of their lines of evidence or of argument to support homeopathy. They often will cite historical cases in which homeopathy was effective in treating an epidemic. But of course, they're going back 150, 200 years. The data is not exactly reliable. You know, 150 years ago, they're going basically on the subjective reports of homeopaths about their own treatments. That's convincing.
But it's irrelevant. It doesn't matter how many things that they can cite in the past. The whole premise is faulty.
Yeah. No, I mean, it can't work and it doesn't work. But the evidence that their best evidence are these historical cases where the quality of the data is completely unverified and it's worthless.
You know? Unverified. And yeah. couldn't you also make the point that there was a time in which it was probably better that you weren't treated by doctors? You were more likely to probably get into trouble because they didn't know what they were doing at the time. There was no science behind a lot of the stuff they were doing.
Yeah, no, you're comparing it to what doctors were doing 150 years ago. That's not saying much.
So Steve, would you cut him a break if he just simply said, "I don't know anything about homeopathy"?
Yeah. So again, he's a politician. If he made a mistake, he could do some due diligence and just admit, hey, I made a mistake. I didn't really understand the full implications of the petition. It sounded like a good idea because I didn't know what homeopathy was. Now I've learned that it's nonsense and totally back away from it. He hasn't done that. He's done this little bit of a political shuffle where he's trying to distance himself from it, but he's not really coming out and saying homeopathy is nonsense. So the Green Party in New Zealand has tried to distance themselves from Browning, so much so that they took away his responsibility for the natural health portfolio. So they're merging that with just the overall health portfolio under another MP. So they essentially said, you have nothing to do with healthcare, you know, because you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it's good. So they're doing damage control for their party by distancing themselves from Browning and his support, you know, sort of weak support for homeopathy. And then on the heels of that decision, when he was asked about it, he said that he did not oppose homeopathy on a personal level, but he accepted his caucus's decision. So he doesn't oppose homeopathy, quote unquote, on a personal level. Again, that's exactly the kind of things that politicians in the U.S. say, like, well, I don't oppose creationism on a personal level, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we should be teaching it in public schools. It's kind of like, I'm going to make everybody happy, you know, kind of a response. I don't want to specifically alienate any particular contingent, but they're just taking this maximally wishy-washy position in the middle. But again, when you're dealing with things like homeopathy, anything less than complete and utter condemnation, correctly pointing out that it's witchcraft, it is witchcraft, that's what it is unacceptable. You know, there's just it's not the kind of thing you can take a nuanced or wishy-washy position on, you know?
But, yeah, and this is the kind of reaction I like seeing. People who are even just wishy-washy about it, they need to be marginalized, and that's what it looks like his group is trying to do to him, and that's the reaction we want. Because the next guy is going to think twice about spouting such nonsense publicly.
Right, exactly. All right, well, Evan, I'm looking at a very cool picture of a vampire deer or something like that. Tell me about this.
Vampire deer, yeah, well... Well, Steve and folks, I'm sure you've heard of, let's say, the white-tailed deer, right? We've all heard of that, pretty common. We probably heard of the red deer, maybe. Or you've even heard of a reindeer. And you've even heard doe a deer at some point in your life. But I defy the SGU listener to have ever heard of a Cashmere musk deer, at least prior to recent news headlines. And because you have probably never heard of this species of deer before, and their whose official taxonomical designation is Moschus cupreus, it's one of seven Moschidae species found in Asia. This Cashmere musk deer is, in fact, quite an interesting animal in that the males of the species grow tusks, and the tusks can grow as long as 10 centimeters. Or rather, what is that, 100 millimeters? Because someone told us recently that centimeter measurements is rubbish. Who is it who said that?
Yeah, some metric fanatic.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I made a reasonable argument, but the point was that centimeters are confusing, and the only reason why people use them is because they're sort of inches. But it's for conversion purposes, just sticking with millimeters is less confusion.
Okay. Right. So 100 millimeters, let's call it.
All right.
And, of course, what with Halloween having just recently come and all, they are being called in the news as vampire deer, like you said, Steve, and like the picture implies. Kind of a cool-looking creature, saber-toothed deer, sort of, you know, a little throwback.
Is that real? That looks Photoshopped.
No, it's real. And Cashmere musk deer are not the only species of deer to grow tusks like that, just one of them. But why is this deer in the news lately? It's not because it's vampire or Halloween or anything like that. It's much cooler. The deer had not been officially seen since 1948. And that led a lot of people in the scientific community to think, well, maybe this species has gone extinct, which would be really, really unfortunate. But the deer has been reportedly sighted in northeastern Afghanistan. And it was spotted by a team of researchers who were in the Nuristan province of Afghanistan during 2008 and 2009. And they recorded 5 sightings of the animal. And it was, like I said, first time since 1948 that there had been any sort of official sighting. And it was described in this month's edition of the journal Oryx. That's O-R-Y-X. So here's what they did. The survey team recorded 5 sightings, including a solitary male in the same area on 3 occasions, 1 female with a juvenile, and 1 solitary female, which may have been the same individual without her young. They're not sure. But all the sightings were in steep, rocky outcrops, interspersed with alpine meadows and scattered, the animals were kind of scattered, among the dense brushes of juniper and rhododendron that are kind of up on these hillsides where it's very difficult for poachers and, you know, other animals to kind of get to them. So it was sort of like a little area of protection for them. They couldn't be photographed. Now that I don't understand. I don't know why they couldn't get photographs of them. Did they not bring long enough lenses or something? I understand you can't approach these things, but I don't know why.
You can't photograph vampires.
Rebecca, I didn't think of that.
So, yeah, that's probably it.
Now, here's the thing about these creatures. They are listed as an endangered species on the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Their red list, in which they, you know, classify which species are becoming extinct and so forth, and to what degree. It is hunted. The animal is hunted for its scent glands, and they're very, very valuable because some people believe the glands have pharmaceutical properties. Also, because of the name, as the name implies, they have a musk to them or a scent, and their glands, they drop these little pellets out of their glands, which are kind of like near their backsides, and they're harvested for perfumes and other fragrances and these sorts of things. But they're killed instead of captured and put onto a farm, because I think they said that you don't get the same smell out of them. You have to capture them in the wild as opposed to having them on farms and kind of just picking up their droppings as they go around the farms. So unfortunately, these things are being killed, and that's really a sad thing. The fangs themselves, as far as the deer are concerned, are used as tusks in a sense. They clash with other males during mating season. So these are a very, very good. Very, very happy to read this sort of news. When you think something's been gone for a long time, there's been no sight of it for decades, and all of a sudden, there you have it. There it is.
Yeah, but it's sad that they're being hunted for their glands, you know. You know, you can look at the picture of the skulls. You know, the skulls, you see where the tusks are coming from, and they're huge. They're really big. You know, they're only like the bottom third or whatever is sticking out from underneath their mouth.
Oh, wow, but, really?
Yeah, you can see how much bigger they are when you look at the skull. All right. Thanks, Evan. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about time.
Yeah. Everybody sit back. This is going to be a long one.
Yep. And it's about time.
It's about time. So yeah, until recently, our most accurate clock has been the so-called atomic clock, which uses a cesium atom to tell time. Specifically, 1 second is the amount of time it takes a cesium atom to oscillate 9,192,631,770 times. Got that?
Yes.
It'll be a test later.
So a cesium atom is a clock in its own right.
Yeah. Well, every atom is a clock in its own right. It's just the cesium atom they chose and worked out well. You know, the oscillations were able to be counted to this exact amount that we can use in every atomic clock so that we have some amount of precision.
Nice.
So that was up until this past year when scientists at the National Institute of Standards and Technology developed an even more precise clock using lasers, which they call an optical clock. Lasers oscillate like 1,000,000,000,000 times per second, which would allow for even more precise measurements. But unfortunately, it's so fast that it's really hard, if not impossible, to count every cycle. So instead, the researchers used a device called a femtosecond pulsed laser to count every 100,000th oscillation. And then they used an atom that would oscillate in time with the laser in order to regulate the speed. And for the record, a femtosecond is 1/4 of a second. That's 1,000,000th of 1,000,000,000th of 1 second. So
we've talked about femtometers we've mentioned on the show before, right, Bob?
Yes, we have.
Mm-hmm. So the researchers found that a cooled mercury atom was just right, at least for now. And now the clock is operating in Boulder, Colorado, counting out those femtoseconds. Theoretically, this clock could keep perfect time for 5 billion years, though they'd probably have to change the battery once or twice. They might at some point change to a different kind of atom to get even more precise than the mercury atom. But for now, the clock is good enough to start to raise some questions about what time is and how we measure it. In fact, I think that there's an old physics joke that's like, what is time? Time is the thing that clocks measure. It's a difficult question to answer. As NPR recently reported, the clock is so precise that two of these clocks operating in different places on Earth, so say one in Death Valley and one all the way at the top of Mount Everest, would quickly become out of sync due to the relativity of time being different at different gravities.
That's awesome.
Yeah, like Just let that sink in for a minute.
That blew me away. And, you know, it's one of those things where I was like, of course, that makes perfect sense. And
it does.
I was kind of shocked that I hadn't extrapolated in the past thinking, well, yeah, if we had clocks that were really crazy accurate, then if one was 2 feet higher on the wall than the other one, they would be out of sync. And it's like, yeah, that is a problem. And it's so fascinating.
And you're right. It is so precise that it's a matter of inches. You know, if one clock is slightly higher than the other, it's going to be off because things that are slightly higher in general will be moving faster through time than something lower, which is crazy, to imagine, but it's
true. Do they try and succeed at making them the same height?
Well, altitude? Right now there's just the one clock.
Okay.
But it's true that like at this point with this clock, our absolute scale of time in which a second is a second, no matter where you are, goes out the window. It would be impossible to keep all of these clocks in sync. Yeah. and you know, so if you have, one clock in another country and you want to make it exactly the same as this clock, it would be pretty much impossible because you would not just have to go based on sea level. You know, you'd have to go based on distance from the center of the earth, you know, and gravity is going to be very different in different places. That's how sensitive these clocks are.
And I read that even as the earth's crust shifts, that creates a difference.
So,
and so the land under your very feet is moving and that's going to mess up.
So the clock doesn't even has to really move, you know, relative to like where you are in your building. It would still fluctuate, which is so, so cool. So how do they plan on resolving this, Rebecca?
Great question, Bob. we know cesium clocks also can be out of sync. And that's why we have International Atomic Time, aka Temps Atomique International, or TAI. And that was created to account for that. TAI is an average of 200 atomic clocks around the world.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa!
Yeah.
So, yeah, presumably you could develop a similar system for optical clocks. So in practice, we would all still have an accurate timekeeping device on Earth. So don't panic about that.
But my question is, what does it mean to be accurate in this particular case? If they're all out of sync with each other.
Well,
which one is accurate?
That's why we talk about precision when we talk about how precise these clocks can be, but we don't talk about accurate because there's nothing for them to be accurate to. All we really need is for this clock to match this other clock, or for us to know at least the differences between these two clocks so that we can all get to brunch on time, basically. Or we can all get to brunch at the same time, I should say. I mean, one way to at least help this problem is to launch all these clocks into space. Once they're outside of the Earth's gravity, they can once again be used to work together to create a sort of standard of time. And eventually that might develop into space time, you know, or whatever you call it. What do they call it on Star Trek? Stardate or whatever. that's how you would do that, is to get them out into space. And that is actually one of the biggest uses for this is in the future. These would be really useful in planning the trajectories of missions that go outside the solar system, because as the objects we send out from Earth get further and further away from us, we're going to require more and more precise ways to plan their movements. And at some point, our current cesium clocks just aren't going to be good enough. Another use for these is not even to do with telling time, but because they are so sensitive to gravity, they can potentially be used to actually study the makeup of the Earth, which is pretty cool. So it's pretty exciting, but right now there is just the one clock, and the researchers at NIST aren't expecting optical clocks to become the standard anytime soon. Jim Berquist, one of the co-authors on the optical clock paper that was published this past summer in Science, he pointed out that not only does the clock still need refinement, like they might change the mercury atom to a different atom, but it took 20 years for the cesium clock to be accepted by the world at large. So it'll probably be another few decades before everybody's ready to make the switch to optical clocks. But in the meantime, it opens up a lot of exciting possibilities and also a lot of philosophical conversations about, you know, what time is and what it means to us and how we measure it.
One thing I thought that was really cool, which you mentioned, is that these clocks are so accurate, they're actually better tools for measuring gravity than for measuring time.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, because the gravity, because of, you know, relativity, will affect them. Not just, you said, mapping out the gravity of the Earth, but measuring gravity waves, you know, from outer space, even. How long, Rebecca, is it going to be until we have a clock that is accurate, that will remain precise, let's say, for the duration of the age of the universe?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, considering that this one isn't even refined yet, and they say that it will, it can keep time for, what was the number?
5 billion years.
Yeah. Considering that this one will keep perfect time for 5 billion years, I mean, a few tweaks here and there, and yeah, I think we'll be good to go.
Yeah. I mean, you know, 5 billion. I mean, come on. Gotta do better than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, gotta talk to me when you got into the trillions.
Well, again, though, what we really need is a battery that will keep it going that long.
Right. So. Right, right. We'll make it solar, but then, you know, the sun's going to run out.
Right. Sun will run out, and then we have to go to another star.
Can't rely on anything in this universe anymore.
No, it's very disappointing.
All right, Bob, you're going to tell us about a mystery at the center of our own galaxy.
Yeah. So I've been waiting for months for what pretty much turned out to be an astronomical no-show, so I'm kind of bummed about it. But you guys remember that huge cloud of gas called G2, love that name, that was about to crash into our supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way? Well, the crash never happened, and now it looks like we know why. It's not a cloud of gas at all, but it's a star, which sounds bizarre. How did they not know that? Well, a little history. In 2000, actually, it was hard to determine exactly. I think 2007, astronomers noticed a fuzzy infrared patch near our galactic core that appeared to be a cloud of gas nearby our 4 million solar mass black hole called Sagittarius A. And that in and of itself wasn't terribly exciting or novel. But what was the fact that it looked like it was going to impact the black hole or perhaps the accretion disk itself in 2014. So such a large impact would be a once in, not a once in a lifetime event, a once in an eon event. Very rare, very special. So this was genuinely exciting. Astronomers have seen such impacts before, but only in, you know, in galaxies millions of light years away, never one like this, so close.
So they only occur in a galaxy far, far away, a long time ago.
Yes, by definition. So Sagittarius A does visibly eat small patches of gas here and there every like 5 to 10 days. So it does happen, and you could see the little flares, I guess. But it's never been observed to eat something this big. So the flares of energy that would be produced would have been awesome. They would have been a sight to behold. And that's why everyone was so excited and so ready for this to happen this year. Observatories on the land and in space were poised to record this amazing event. And they waited and waited, and nothing happened. The time came and went when it was supposed to happen, and it wasn't even a tiny flare. So what the hell happened? And I could relate a little bit. I've been waiting for this news so that I can quickly write a post about it or talk about it on the show. And it's been so delayed, I just kind of forgot about it. And now we know why. Nothing really happened. So the best explanation based on what, on this, the fact that nothing happened and other evidence like the dust, that is around this object. So it's now believed that the cloud of gas was really shrouding a really big star. And this is funny because as I look at older news items about this topic, it seems that there was more than a minority of astronomers that were already thinking along those lines, which struck me as odd because most of the stuff I have read, just it was G2, the space cloud. I mean, it was a cloud of gas. And I didn't read some of the other stuff where they were saying, hey, you know, maybe it's not just a cloud. There could be something hidden within that cloud. It could be a star, which now looks like it, they were correct. Some people were speculating a brown dwarf or maybe a Jovian gas giant, as well. But it's not an ordinary star shrouded in gas, though. It appears to be a star that was once a binary pair that merged into a much bigger single star. And then this star was then surrounded by this envelope of gas and dust. And so the bottom line, a simple diffuse cloud of gas, it would never have you know, probably never have survived the close encounter with the black hole. The tidal forces would have just totally ripped it apart. And if you go online, there's a lot of these video simulations of what the gas cloud being ripped apart would have looked like. And it's beautiful. It's such a beautiful simulation. But of course, it's kind of irrelevant now that it's not really just a diffuse cloud of gas. So a gravitationally compact star, however, apparently has the strength to withstand the close approach that this one had. And some astronomers were saying that it escaped with only minor damage. So now they're thinking that other large stars that are in the neighborhood of the black hole, they may be similar merged binary systems, which means that this could potentially qualify for a new class of star that's created from a binary system that's been thrown together by the gravity of a supermassive black hole in its neighborhood. So we didn't get the beautiful pyrotechnics, but we learned a little bit more, and maybe the star will come back around in a few years or longer, and maybe it will actually collide with the black hole. So that would be interesting as well.
So sometimes, yeah, disappointing or null results are interesting.
Yeah, and sometimes they're extremely telling as well. So it's
all right, David. I promised that you were going to give us a peek into pseudoscience in China. You're going to tell us about Feng Shui.
Yeah, I love saying it like that. Yeah, Feng Shui. Yeah. I guess this is a stereotypical story from my part of the world. But I would like to point out before I start that there is really good science going on here in Hong Kong and right across the border in Shenzhen. Chinese University of Hong Kong does some really great stuff. There's a good research going on there. The biggest genome sequencing center in the entire world is in Shenzhen, and they're doing really good stuff there. But nobody wants to hear about that. They want to hear the stereotypical story. So, Feng Shui. Recently, in the South China Morning Post, there was an article that the local government has spent over $10 million in the last 10 years on what are called Tan Fu ceremonies, or just basically a realignment of qi for locals who have been upset by construction projects. When I looked into this deeper, I found out that this has been going on not for the last 10, 20, 30 years, but it's been going on for over 100 years. When the British first moved into the new territories back in the early 1900s, they were making payments to locals whose lifestyles were upset because their qi was messed up. So in the last 10 years or so, they've been building a high-speed express rail from Hung Hom, which is in sort of downtown Kowloon, through to meet up with the high-speed express train in Guangzhou. And obviously to build this railway, they had to move people, they had to relocate people, they had to change some infrastructure, which meant they tore down some bridges and put up new ones, dug tunnels. And so people's qi was upset by this. If you've planted a tree in your yard for a very particular reason in a very particular location, and that tree has to be cut down or moved, and you want to be compensated. And the problem is not people's qi is upset. The problem is that there's this big pot of money now available. And when we talk about, wasting of government resources, this is a great example. So people will apply to their local government to have a qi master come to their house and perform a ceremony so that their qi can be realigned, or so that ancestors will be able to find them. One of the biggest concerns is that when you're relocated, on the seventh day of the seventh month, the doors of the afterlife are opened and your ancestors will come and visit you. But if you've moved, your ancestors might not be able to find you. And then on top of that, it means that you're being visited by somebody else's ancestors. And so that's not all that great a situation.
How awkward.
Yeah, it's really
awkward. No, we're not. I'm sorry. You want the house two houses down. This has been happening all week.
I hate when that happens.
Exactly. And so the qi master has to come and perform a ritual so that your ancestors will know where to go, and so that someone else's ancestors won't come and visit your house. And what they actually do in this ceremony, I can't honestly tell you. And the truth is, or I shouldn't say the truth, but from what I've been able to determine, neither can they. If you want to be a feng shui master, there really is only, apparently, one requirement, and that is to refer to yourself as a feng shui master. You do have to know the language, you have to know the background, you have to be able to talk the talk if you want to charge large, large sums of money, like $5,000 US a day to show up and perform your ceremony.
Wow.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Nice. Well, yeah. Some of the local feng shui fortune tellers charge, $3,000 and $4,000 per fortune. So they can easily make up to $1.5 million US a year, telling people's fortunes. So it's a bit like the psychic industry in the United States. You can become very, very rich as a psychic. And there's another parallel as well with the psychic industry, and that is that the number of people who actually respect and pay attention to this kind of behavior is about the same. You know, there's a very, very small group who are actually fanatical about it. The problem right now is that there's been this long-standing tradition of paying the local feng shui master and compensating local people when their qi has been upset. And so now we have government members who are standing up and asking, you know, the highways department and the infrastructure departments and the project managers, like, how much money are you paying locals to compensate them for their qi? Why don't we call this what it really is? Why don't we call this some sort of compensation for movement? Because what's happening in between is the most recent one that made the newspaper, as a qi master was asked to come to a village and perform ceremonies on 23 homes, as well as consult on how the town should be realigned in order to make sure that the qi could flow and collect and disperse in all the manners that it's supposed to be. And we can have a whole separate conversation about what qi is, and we can get it over really quick. It's not anything. It doesn't exist. But this guy put in a bid of $2.1 million to come and do these ceremonies. He was negotiated all the way down to $250,000. So the question became, what kind of value are you actually providing when you can do it for 12% of your original price? And why was your original price so high? Well, it turns out his original price was so high because that's how the government determines what they will reimburse. You see, there's no way to assess the value of these ceremonies, none whatsoever. So all the government does when they're assessing whether or not the claim to reimburse the master is reasonable is they look at other claims. So, well, what did we pay the last guy? What did we pay this other guy? What did we pay over in that other village? And how many people is this affecting? And so in a town where there's 23 families or 23 homes that are being affected, and this is a really famous feng shui master, and we've paid these kind of fees before, yeah, sure, $250,000 suddenly seems reasonable. But there's never any assessment of whether or not it actually has any effect. And so it's almost humorous to watch members of the Legislative Assembly stand up and ask questions like, they'll ask questions of the minister or the director of the particular department. Are you making sure that payments for feng shui are being administered under the regulation? And they're saying, well, sure we are. Here are the guidelines. But nowhere in the guidelines and nowhere in the regulations is anyone ever saying, is there any efficacy here at all? Does this work? Does this have a purpose? And even whether you believe in it or not, you're still going to do it because it's a great way to get cash out of the government.
Do you think, I mean, if it is a minority of people who really truly believe in this and are fanatical about it, do you think if politicians did start to phase this sort of thing out, would there be a backlash?
There would be a backlash amongst those whose backlash counts. Right? That's the issue that we face here. This is not an open democracy here. There's only 1,200 people in the city who actually get to elect our chief executive officer. And so amongst those people, amongst the wealthy, if you're spending money on something that has no effect on your life, you're not concerned about that. If you have no money, then anything to the feng shui master seems unsensible. But if you're ridiculously rich, as many people here in Hong Kong who have the influence are, then you're unconcerned with a check for $250,000 going to a feng shui master, and it doesn't become an issue. And let's not forget the feng shui masters themselves are very wealthy in many cases, and so they can influence the politics, they can influence what happens. And then there's the third standing issue, is that it's just been tradition. At what point does someone in government stand up and say, we need to stop doing this? Because people would say, we've been doing this for over 100 years. Right? What made it wrong then? What makes it wrong now if it was right then? So there's these internal arguments. And the third thing is that politicians here are not motivated by these kind of issues. There are much, much bigger issues. And that's why it's hard to actually get skepticism up and running, because the issues here are much, much, much bigger. But as we know, this kind of thinking leads to other kinds of faulty.
Yeah, once you start believing in magic and nonsense, then it's springtime for the charlatans,
absolutely,
as someone said.
And when you can use this magic and nonsense to actually get money out of the government,
mm-hmm,
right? Because you can say, you know, this would be the effect of someone saying, Sylvia Brown is the only name that comes to mind, but I know she's passed away, being paid by the local police force a handsome sum of money to participate in a murder, mm-hmm, mystery, right? That would be the equivalent. And then it becoming not just acceptable, but part of the culture that all police forces hired psychics.
Right. Yeah, it's a good analogy. Or a president consulting an astrologer.
Yeah, exactly.
The schedule.
And,
yeah.
Right. And since there's absolutely no way to determine the value of what it is that they're doing, they can charge anything they want. I have examples.
Yeah.
I have, reading some of the past articles. And what's really frustrating, though, is that it gets pervasive into the way people do business as well. Because, so let's say you're going to open an ice cream shop. You know, there's a famous story here in Hong Kong about a guy opening an ice cream shop. The feng shui master will actually show up and give you terrible architectural advice. Really terrible architectural advice about where to locate the cash register based on his idea about where the chi is going to flow. Now, we all know the cash register should be far over to the right and the service counters over to the left. I mean, you design flow the way flow goes. But instead, they'll say, oh, no, right here in the center, this is where all the chi is. And so this is where all the money is going to go. So this is where you want your cash register. So, Rebecca, I will take you to restaurants and places where you stop and you look and you go, this doesn't make any sense. Why is this designed like this? Why would you have the counter right there? And then someone will say, well, that's...
Well, because if it wasn't right there, that cashier's relatives who are dead would never be able to find him.
Right, you know? So the chi just wouldn't flow. And this whole thing, I like to say that all of the different Chinese beliefs are like moons around one planet, and that planet is chi. Everything, mm-hmm, is around,
yeah,
chi. Feng shui, all about chi. Astrology, all about chi. You know, yin and yang, all about chi. Traditional Chinese medicine, all about managing your chi, 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 chi. We actually had an anthropologist from the university come and speak to our group a couple of months about chi, and it got so heated I had to go to the front of the group and say, okay, stop, 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 stop. I had to shut everybody down. Because people were just frustrated that he kept implying, no, it's a real thing, it's a real thing. Or at least he wasn't, he was doing what your New Zealand politician was doing. He was saying, can we really say it's not a real thing? You know, he sort of taking,
yeah,
who knows, who knows, who knows? Well, that's right, who does know? No one knows.
All right, well, thank you so much, David. That was fascinating.
You're welcome.
Evan, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
Thanks, Steve. I'll do just that by playing for you last week's Who's That Noisy? Here we go.
Sounds like a noise from an alien, one of those weird aliens from Star Trek. Wasn't that like the Halloween episode that they actually had? Those funky little frail creatures.
There's a Star Trek Halloween episode?
Yes. Yeah, they were in a dungeon. They were in a big castle and black cats and skeletons. And yeah, it wasn't a good episode, but
Sounds terrible.
Not a good episode.
Cat's paw.
What I notice about the sound, Evan, is that it has that characteristic progressive increase in frequency.
Yes.
Like when anything, like if you're spinning a coin around, as it goes faster, 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 faster and faster, you know, sort of a geometric increase in the frequency of whatever's happening. So that's
saying there's sort of a mathematic occurrence happening here, a ratio of some sort, perhaps. This is a sound. This is a sound I first came across when I was 8 years old. I lived down the street from a large lake, which would freeze. Of course, we're in the northeast of the United States.
It
would freeze every winter. And what you do with your friends is, yes, you either go out on the ice and risk death, or you take some rocks and you skim them along the surface of the ice. And that's what you get. And Steve, yeah, back to the math part of that, you know, skimming rocks, you know, it'll hit once and that's kind of your first measurement. Then it'll go again kind of at a half measurement almost practically. And then a quarter and then an eighth and then so forth. So there is that system, inherent in the noise. And certainly as the rock goes, and yes, that is that noise. A noise that lots of people are familiar with. Oh boy, hundreds of correct guesses, I would say, on this one. So
it's
lots of people.
It's a popular YouTube video or Facebook video. Yeah,
it is. It is. And a recent version of it, it was making the rounds just recently in the last couple of weeks. So yeah, I decided to snag it.
We also had a one of your previous Who's That Noises was a cracking glacier. And it sounded like that, too. That's the sound that ice makes, I guess.
It did. And there were plenty of guests who were also guessing that. And they said, didn't you use that not too long ago?
Yeah.
And I responded and said, yes, what you were guessing is what I used a few weeks ago. But that's not the correct answer this week. So rocks across the frozen pond is this past week. So congratulations, Max K. from Sweden. You are this week's winner. Your name goes into the drawing at the end of the year, which is only... a few weeks away. And if we pull your name out, Max, you're going to join us for an episode of Science or Fiction coming up in early 2015. Well done.
And what do you got for this week?
Here we go. Let's see what you make of this particular noise. This is a fun one. Here we go.
It's a stuffed animal orgy.
Ew.
This is a sound that occurs in nature. I think some of our listeners will have an upper hand on this one. And we'll see as the guesses roll in. And they're going to roll into our email address for Who's That Noisy Guesses. Let's see. Oh, yeah. WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Send us your guess there. Or go on to our forums, SGUforums.com, and post on the... heading there under Who's That Noisy. Each episode is listed there. Post your guess. Have fun. Good luck, everyone.
Now, Evan, we are coming up on our advanced recording schedule for Australia and New Zealand. So we're going to get out of sync with Who's That Noisy.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to do a Who's That Noisy on the next episode because we will not have had a chance to get any responses. We'll do it in 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks, we'll get the follow-up to what this noisy is. And then we have 3 weeks where we're using older episodes that we recorded.
Right.
Yeah. So basically, we'll be back then with fresh episodes. Then we'll have episodes that we recorded while we were in Australia and New Zealand. And then I think it's going to be the end of December before we get back to new episodes.
Whoa.
Yeah. So... anyway, there'll be one more Who's That Noisy in 2 weeks, and then basically we're going to have a break until the end of the year.
So only a few chances left to get into the end of year drawing.
One. I think this one enough. then 2 weeks from now, and that's pretty much it. Yeah.
That'll be it. All right.
Okay.
Well, I wish everyone luck.
All right. Thanks, Ev. Well, guys, it's time to move on to science or fiction.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week in honor of David being on the show. The theme is China.
Uh-oh.
So I tried to find some crazy shit about China.
I feel like somebody has an advantage here.
Yeah.
You have a hard time.
I had an embarrassment of riches. I had so many things to choose from. Now, I just want to say before I even go into this that I'm not trying to pick on China or, you know, make fun of them or anything. As David was pointing out, we all have insanity in every culture. It's easy to pick out the insanity in other cultures more than your own. There are lots of things where it's only interesting because from an American perspective, it's just different. It's just culturally different. But in any way, these are 3 different kind of items. They're not all bad. Anyway, here we go. Item number 1. Over 100 elementary schools in China are sponsored by tobacco companies who have their name on the school, logo on the school uniforms, and the walls contain slogans such as, quote, "Work hard for society. Tobacco can help you become an achiever." Item number 2, some police stations in China use guard geese instead of dogs to keep watch at night. And item number 3, the Guinness Book of World Records lists Ma Yu Ching's Bucket Chicken House in Kaifeng as the oldest documented restaurant in the world, in continuous operation in the same location since 1153 AD. Bob, go first.
All of these seem believable. Let's see. The tobacco company schools. Yeah, I mean, I think generally, and I'm not sure which countries. I know countries like Japan where smoking is perceived so differently than here. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was similar in China. Yeah, I could see that. I really can't think of anything. It sounds so bizarre to us, but I could believe it. The guard geese, I could see that as well. I mean, I've seen how aggressive geese can be. Not that they're going to really hurt you, but they certainly would make noise, I would think, and get people's attention. So that's kind of believable as well. The bucket chicken, 1153. Yeah, that just seems like too long. Oof. Yeah, what the hell? I mean, might as well just toss a coin. Yeah, I'm going to say the bucket chicken is fiction.
All right, Jay.
Okay, this first one about the schools being sponsored by tobacco companies. Yeah, I mean, sure. I see, like, why wouldn't they do that, you know? Tobacco companies would do that here in the United States if it weren't so hated and against the law at this point. The guard geese, I mean, I just don't get that. Like, are geese even up at night? I don't know. You know, these are things that we need to figure out. What I do know about geese is they poop a lot, and it's everywhere, and that part of it would really suck. So I'm going to weigh that as I speak about this last one, about the Guinness Book of World Records. There is something so phenomenally adorable about, the chicken bucket house, and the fact that, you know, they pretty much invented Kentucky Fried Chicken like so long ago. You know, I mean, I could totally see that there was a restaurant that survived the whole time. Yeah, it seems a little unlikely. And that's why I'm going to go with the second one about the geese. I think that's the fake.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah, for me, it's between the chicken and the geese. I unfortunately am pessimistic enough to completely believe the tobacco company won. Like, why wouldn't they? They've got the money. They want to recruit kids, you know, and it's probably still legal there. So, yeah, I can see that one happening. Geese are total jerks, though. And so I hate geese. They're probably on my list of the top five worst birds. So I can totally see them being good watch animals. Like, you can't really train them, but they do make a lot of noise, and they will like chase after you if you are in their territory. And yeah, they poop everywhere. So why would you even want to go where they are? It's weird, but I can see it happening. The bucket chicken house is cool, and I want it to be true. But yeah, 1153 AD, that's a long time for a bucket chicken house to be going through, like, I don't know, like wars and different political crap. I don't know. I can't imagine a restaurant being open for that long. So I'll say that one's the fiction too.
Okay. Evan?
I don't know about this tobacco companies. 100 elementary schools? That's really strange. But I don't know. I guess 100 elementary schools in China isn't that much. It's really quite small, actually, when you think about it. How many billion people are there? I mean, really? So we're talking a very small sliver of schools. Perhaps that's right. The guard geese. Rebecca hates geese. I hate gander myself. And guard geese instead of dogs. Well, why would you even have to qualify that? I mean, you know, there's other animals that can stand guard. I'm not sure. The oldest bucket chicken house. Well, I'm going to say that's the geese one. It's guard geese to keep watch at night. So yeah, I don't get that. That one's just making the least amount of sense of the three of these to me. So it's geese fiction.
All right. So David, we have an even split between two and three. You going to straighten everybody out?
Okay. So let's see if I can actually use my knowledge of China to sort of deduce this. The first one about the tobacco company sponsoring schools. I've never specifically heard of that, but I don't think that tobacco has the kind of villainous appearance in China that it has in the West. And I think the kind of things that the tobacco companies would stress in those environments are probably good agricultural practices and a good work ethic, particularly the agricultural practices, because they would be really particular about the kind of tobacco leaf they get. The second one, using dogs instead of dogs, I think, is the key phrase there. You have to remember what some Chinese people think about dogs. Some Chinese people believe that dogs are inhabited by the spirits of their ancestors, and so can't be quite sure whose ancestor is living in that particular dog, so you might not trust a particular dog. Geese also, too, probably would be able to feed themselves, whereas dogs would have to be fed every day, where geese would just live off the whatever grass you could grow around or what was ever in the water. And then the last one, the date, 1153 AD, it would seem to me, and also to the bucket chicken house one, that's just not a phrase I've ever heard, not sure what bucket chicken is, but if you're thinking about like a KFC kind of thing, and the date, 1153 AD, if that had said BC, I think I would have believed that, but it seems to me that there'd probably be restaurants in Greece or Italy or in that part of the world that would be older than that, but I'm not sure. So I'm going to have to go with number three.
Yay! The bucket chicken.
Yeah.
All right.
It makes me feel better.
I feel more confident.
Interesting. All mm-hmm. right. So you all agree that over 100 elementary schools in China are sponsored by tobacco companies who have their name on the school logo on the school uniforms, and the walls contain slogans such as, "Work hard for society. Tobacco can help you become an achiever." All think that one is science, and that one is science,
yeah,
unfortunately. Baby. So a lot of this happened after the earthquake destroyed a lot of the schools. And in 2008, the China earthquake. And so the tobacco companies swooped in with their millions of dollars and said, "We'll rebuild the schools for you." And did so, slap their names on there. And used it as an opportunity to indoctrinate elementary school children into the wonders of smoking.
So do they have like specific menthol schools and low tar schools? How does that work?
So it actually is illegal to advertise cigarettes in China. So there is still this some of the negative connotation to the tobacco industry. But it's not illegal to sponsor. So this is just a way around the prohibition on advertising. The slogan really, the slogans are the most despicable thing, you know, basically promoting, they're directly promoting, you know, smoking to 10-year-olds. A survey done by Beijing University of college students, they were asked, like, how old were you when you had your first cigarette? The average age was 10 years old.
Ah!
So it's, apparently it's working. It's terrible, terrible. All right, let's go to the second one. Some police stations in China use guard geese instead of dogs to keep watch at night. Jay and Evan think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Yeah!
Woo, hooray, baby!
So.
I hate gander even.
Yeah, I read several, I always tried to at least double source any of these items just to make sure that, you know, that it wasn't just an urban legend or something. But yeah, multiple reports and reliable, like National Geographic, you know, I think National Geographic is pretty reliable, say that some rural, police stations no longer using dogs. They specifically mentioned that they're no longer using dogs and they're using geese to stand guard at night because they make a lot of noise. You know, anything that disrupts them and they're obviously not attack geese, although geese can be pretty uppity. But
yeah, they're jerks.
Yeah, they will make a lot of noise. And they actually give an instance where a gentleman tried to break into a police station at nighttime to take back his motorcycle, which had been confiscated. And the geese made a lot of noise, awakened the sleeping police officers who were able to attend to the situation. An anecdote about the efficacy of guard geese. I think guard alligators would be good.
Oh.
I mean, only if you have like a lake for them to
drown
their
victims. Yeah, if you have a moat with guard alligators.
I was going to say, didn't they try that like back in the 15th century or something?
Sure, sure. Boats.
Yeah. But alligators don't make a lot of noise from what I understand.
Yeah, but they don't have to. They'll eat any intruder.
Yeah, see, Steve, I think most of these things are based on, you know, driving people away without murder.
Oh.
You're looking at a different situation.
So my miniature long-haired dachshund would have been is a great guard animal.
Perfect.
Completely harmless, noisy as hell.
Yeah.
At anything. Yeah.
Yeah, but can his stomach acids dissolve bone?
I never found out. Okay, let's get to the third one. The Guinness Book of World Records lists Ma Yu Ching's Bucket Chicken House in Kaifeng as the oldest documented restaurant in the world in continuous operation in the same location since 1153 AD. And that one, of course, is the fiction. However, very interesting, multiple sources do claim that that restaurant is, in fact, the oldest restaurant in the world, dating to 1153.
That's what I thought.
That goes back to the Song Dynasty. However, it's not documented. They don't have any documentation proving it.
No receipt? No.
So the Guinness Book of World Records does not accept it. They list as the oldest restaurant in the world the Casa Botín in Madrid, which dates back to 1725. That's the one that's listed in the Guinness Book of Records, 1725. But this one, you know, it's basically a local story that this restaurant is that old. It's not impossible. It may in fact be true. It's just there's no documentation of it, so it's not accepted as proven to be true. Not sure what the bucket chicken is a reference to, but some of the sources I read point to the fact that in 1855, Ma Yoren, who was a descendant of the original Mr. Ma, moved back to his ancestral home in the village of Laodong, Kaifeng, bringing with him a bucket of the traditional sauce. And then he established the roast chicken shop in 1864. So some people say that's really the date, you know, and that I can't really say that it was the same restaurant before that. But anyway, so it's a little controversial. Specializing in quote-unquote bucket chicken.
Awesome. I'm going to look it up. We'll have some while you're here.
But do they make vegan bucket chicken?
I was just going to say, right. Yeah, we'll get it.
Sorry.
Let me let me tell you some of the runners up that I didn't choose.
Yeah.
So these are all true. These are all seem to be facts. So one is that between 2011 and 2012, so in just 2 years, China created more concrete than the United States did in the 20th century.
Yeah, that's true.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
But they build whole cities that, like, nobody
lives in. Yeah, yeah. There are some abandoned ghost cities in China.
I read that, yeah.
Here's a little stat if you're interested. How many empty apartments do you think there are in China?
Oh, as a percentage?
Yeah, no, as a number.
6 million.
100 million.
100 Evan, billion.
Evan, you're closest. You're closest.
Thank you.
64 million apartments. 64 million empty apartments. Again, like I say, it's hard to even imagine the number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
David, is this the truthful explanation of where Rebecca is staying?
Yeah.
Your pick.
Tucking me into an empty apartment.
Why are you interested in where Rebecca is staying? I'm curious about that.
I am coming to see you, and I want to know what I can expect.
Well, you can expect exactly the same treatment Rebecca is getting, so she will be able to fill you in when she sees you in Australia.
Yeah, I'll report back.
That's nonsense.
I'll be the canary in the coal mine. Rebecca.
Well, I will get you bucket chicken. How's that?
There are more smokers in China than there are people in the United States.
Yeah.
Wow. Totally.
They consume 50,000 cigarettes every second, China. 50,000 a second. A millionaire philanthropist in China, China's Chen Guangjiao, decided to sell cans of fresh air to people who were beleaguered by the Beijing's ever-worsening air pollution and made $6 million in 2 weeks selling cans of fresh air. They had different flavors. One of the flavors was pristine Tibet, and another flavor was post-industrial Taiwan.
Wow.
All right. Have you heard of this one, David? There is a thriving black market in fake chicken eggs.
Yeah, I have heard that one.
Oh, I've heard of that, yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Yes, they're pink and plastic. They separate in the middle and give candy.
Yeah, they thing. Like real fake eggs with the shell on and everything.
Real fake egg, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that I've had them before. I'm pretty sure that I've seen them.
They make them out of resin and they get some kind of powdery calcium-based thing to make a pretty credible shell on the outside. Yep. Apparently, they have machines where you could make, like, one person with the ingredients in a machine could make 1,500 in a day.
Yeah.
And when you mass produce them, they cost a lot less than real chicken eggs. So that's why they can be very profitable.
You know what the company's tagline is?
can't wait to hear.
The yolk's on you.
So Steve, though, is that meant to be a scam? Is it meant to be what? Okay, so
it's not a chicken egg substitute. They're scam fake chicken eggs.
Yeah, they don't sell them as fake. Yeah. They sell them as real, right alongside the real.
All right, so take them home, crack them open, and start cursing in Chinese.
That is legitimately the beginning of the Blade Runner movie. Yeah. That was like 100 years before Blade Runner was filmed.
That's funny you say that, Jay, because that's the total vibe I get when I think about these like overcrowded Chinese cities with all this stuff going on. It's Blade Runner.
It absolutely is, guys.
Without the replicants.
You guys have got to come here.
And the flying cars.
David, you set it up. You set it up, and we will come. You know, you get a big enough event for us to pay for us to go there, and we'll go. All right. Well, Jay, you're going to close this out with a quote?
I have an awesome quote from an awesome guy. This quote was sent in by a listener named Duff Dyer from Columbus, Ohio.
Great name.
I'm going to read this quote, and I want everyone to guess who it is. Boy, the idea of chaos is a scary proposition to some people. It is a scary proposition. And they will believe some ridiculous things to avoid the idea of having to deal with chaos. I say bring it on.
Feynman?
That was my guess.
Mandelbrot?
Very Feynman-esque.
Brian Greene?
The one, the only. George Robb!
Awesome.
All right. Well, David, thanks for joining us. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, great
job. You're
welcome.
If you want to join Hong Kong Skeptics in the Club, just check us out on meetup.com. And if you want to come and see Rebecca while she's in town November 20th, the tickets are on Eventbrite. November 21st in Dongguan. Tickets are on Eventbrite.
Awesome. Have a great time, guys.
I want to see pictures.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Fun Doctor. Show.
Thanks, everyone.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.